access number 27068, Mr. George Wolfe, Reel 6. Now, we're talking about, you know, this period when you didn't have a lot to do. Wireless traffic had reduced. You weren't doing any interrogation or translation. Yeah. You had some leave in Rome. And then what's the next thing after that?
The next thing I remember is we went back to Naples in order to embark to go to do the southern, after D-Day, the invasion of southern France, which was the naval units and the army were embarked in Naples. And we were seen off at the time by Sir Winston Churchill, who gave us a cheery wave from a little motor yacht, which he was on as we left Naples Harbour. And then we landed in...
Now, which ship were you on? Do you know?
No idea. Absolutely no idea.
British?
A British ship, and it was probably one of the Liberty type of ships. It wasn't, or was it a warship? I can't remember now.
Doesn't matter. What do you remember of the invasion then?
The invasion had taken place about, well, we were aboard ship while the invasion actually took place. We were offshore for a couple of days. And then when the army had moved in, and there was very little resistance at the time, we landed in San Rafael, which was near Saint-Tropez, one of the very well-known southern French Mediterranean resorts. And we only spent about a week ashore there.
What were you doing? Any particular work or duties you remember?
Yes, well, we actually... As far as I can remember, we didn't take any vehicles ashore. We operated from aboard ship. And then I went back to Naples. We also did, and again, I don't know exactly where this fits in. I did a few weeks on Corsica.
Well, tell us about that.
We were stationed in the Corsican mountains near Ajaccio, operating.
What was going on there? What do you remember of that?
All I remember is that we were up in the mountains and doing our normal duty roster. Nothing much happened. There was an unfortunate incident that our CO... who we had a visit from young American officer, and SYCO took him back to his own unit, the other end of the island. He managed to crash his jeep down the mountainside. The young American officer was killed, but our CO got away without a scratch. That's the only exciting bit I remember of Corsica.
And you were just doing the same duties?
Same duties.
Much wireless traffic?
No. By that time, there wasn't much. As a matter of fact, once we'd finished with Salerno and Anzio at the time, once we got towards past Rome, traffic was very little, except... We by that time we more or less left the Air Force traffic, and I can't remember whether by that time I was attached to an army unit or whether we just helped the army.
Now, how did you help the army?
We helped the army by there was a new German idea. A telephone link was set up between Italy and practically the whole of the Western Front by radio telephone, which was linked via various what do you call these masts, sort of like we have now with mobile phones, various it was called a directional beam radio beam, which was passed from relay station to relay station. Now, this was another novel idea by the Germans, thinking that this was a way of communicating without intercept being possible. The only thing snag was that somebody hadn't thought of the idea that each radio beam has a reciprocal, which came our way, and therefore we were being able to listen to practically all their chat. And this was army traffic, nothing to do with the Air Force. And there were operators all through the night who were connecting various army top personnel to one another all over Germany, even sending personal messages. And these people were chatting when they had nothing to do during the small hours of the morning, telling us that they were expecting new rations, their cigarettes coming through the Brenner Pass, things like that. And of course the immediate reaction was, we send up the planes to bomb those trains coming through with the new rations, and so that I don't think they ever received very many rations. And then as the Germans gradually fell back in Italy, what struck us most was, because of the bombing we did of their rail network and rail communications, that they left behind practically all their armor, not because the armor was useless or shot to pieces, they just didn't have the fuel to put in the tanks and the armored personnel carriers, so that a lot of them went back with horse and carts and things because they'd completely run dry of fuel. And
now, did you have any special equipment to interpret these signals from the German wireless telephony?
No.
What do you call it?
Yeah, radio telephony. No, we didn't. We just used our own sets, because once we found the frequency again they were working on, it was easy to intercept them on the reciprocal. So that was quite effective, quite enjoyable. As a matter of fact, I remember one night they in one little Italian village, they were bragging of having captured a couple of British airmen who'd obviously bailed out, and they were holding them in the local jail, ready to pass on to the German headquarters the next day or something for probably execution, I don't know. And we managed to get onto the army, who managed to send out a patrol to rescue these airmen, which I thought was a great achievement. We were very proud of that at the time. That was another incident. And then gradually the Italian campaign more or less fizzled out by then, once Monte Cassino was captured. And we got as far as Bologna. We did spend the winter of, what was it, 44-45, was very harsh, I remember, on the Adriatic coast, and we had several very nasty storms. And I remember one night our tent was blown off took off, and we were left out in the cold and just huddled in one of the technical vehicles we had for the rest of the night. It was a very nasty experience, because part of the tents collapsed onto the leads, and they had a bit of a job creeping out from underneath, because wet tents can get very heavy. The other thing I remember was I was trying from my unit about 30, 40 miles from Bologna, I was trying to get get some messages onto an aircraft, one of these mail planes from Bologna to Britain. And I was speeding along in the Jeep, and hadn't realized that one of the rivers was actually to be crossed on a Bailey Bridge. I didn't realize the ramps you had to negotiate up and down these Bailey bridges, and I hit the ramp at about 60 mile an hour and took off, but managed to land on all four wheels and cross without major incident. That could have been nasty. But that more or less finished the me. I mean, when we heard in, when was it?
Could you tell from the wireless transmissions that the Germans were getting near the end?
Yes, yes, definitely. I mean,
the
morale was low. And by that time, most of them had realized they wanted to get home. They'd realized that the show was nearly over, that there was no chance of them winning the war. And also, I believe, by that time, the officers had more or less decided that it was futile because, I mean, they were really on the retreat by then. And also, of course, the army in France was by that time nearing the German border. It was the winter of 44-45, when obviously that was just before the Battle of the Bulge, which was a bit of a setback for a couple of months. But once that was repulsed, things went back to normal, and we felt, you know, the war was nearly over. And of course, one thing I forgot to mention, that as practically as soon as we went into Italy proper, that the Italian army surrendered anyway.
How did you get on with the Italians, the civilians?
On the whole, very well. I mean, the civilians, I mean, we've had several. I remember we were stationed in a castle type or manor house type of thing with a very rich Italian, I think he was titled Duke or something, and he was extremely friendly. All he enjoyed was a game of poker with the lads every night, and he looked after us from a point of view of food. There was plenty of food, and his domestic staff was still operating, and everything was really normal, and it was a thoroughly enjoyable experience. We actually used the castle for our own purposes for a few weeks until we marched on again. And there was another time when we, for a week or two, we were stationed in an Italian home for mentally, private home for mentally handicapped people. And one of these patients fell very much in love with one of our sergeants. It was a great tragedy when we had to move on.
So what happened next then?
Next, oh yes. Well, once actually hostilities had ceased.
How did you hear the news? I mean, did you actually pick it up on the wireless, or, you know, when were you first told the war had ended?
Well, I think you know, it was sort of our broadcast people picked it up, and we were told. I mean, we knew that it was a matter of a day or two. You know,
were there celebrations? I mean.
Yes, there were a few. I mean, by that time, we were well supplied with rations and naffy rations and things like that. There was some of the lads had a good drink and that. And it wasn't anything. I mean, we weren't anywhere in civilized where we could really enjoy a big celebration. But you know,
did you have a drink with them all?
Yes. Yeah. I never drank very much, but, you know, the odd drop of brandy or something like that was quite useful.
How did you feel about the end of the war? What, you know, cause
relief, I must admit. But we hadn't finished. This was the funny part. I mean, there was no way. By that time, shortly after that, they announced the dates of various ideas of sort of when people were going to be demobilized. And I knew I wasn't going to be demobilized until towards summer 1946. So we were, by that time we'd entered Austria, and I spent the winter 45-46 in Austria. First of all, I was attached to RAF HQ Austria as a senior interpreter there.
What did that involve?
Well, it involved sort of liaising between local people and the RAF. There were people like the local mayors of little towns and villages who had various requests and that, and came to the town manager in to the headquarters, and I was sent to places to sort of interpret what the requests were and what the necessity. And then also I had to arrange billets for RAF personnel coming out from England as part of the occupation army.
And where would you put them? I mean, how did you go about arranging billets?
Knocking on doors and saying, you know, I'm taking your flat and your flat and your flat, and which in some cases wasn't too pleasant, but I used to try and pick out the people which we knew through various lists and also to local communication, where the chief Nazis were. Some of them obviously had fled, so the places were empty, and I just requisitioned them. And I think I told you about myself. I managed to get a room in a flat with some people who looked after me very well, actually, except the daughter, who was a fully paid-up member of the Nazi Party and couldn't stand the sight of the British or any other of the Allied forces.
How did she show that? I don't think
she showed. Yes, she showed it in a way that she just ignored and made. She moved out, and the parents told me that, you know, they didn't see eye to eye politically for a long time, but she, you know, she was an adult. She was in her mid twenties or something. And she just couldn't bear the idea that they'd actually lost the war.
Were most Austrians friendly? That sounds awful.
Well, the funny thing is, of course, that in those days, very few admitted to ever having been Nazis, you know. I mean, that was the funny part. If you'd asked them, none of them had been party members, none of them had been Nazis, none of them knew anything about concentration camps or anything. So, you know, but I met one who admitted it, and admitted he thought he'd made a mistake, but that he was fully convinced, and he actually gave me a souvenir of his, what was it called, Ehrendolch, which, what was it in English, was a sort of sidearm which they carried, a knife, which with the insignia, the SS insignia on it, and then I threw that away as soon as I got on ship going home. Anyway, then...
You weren't doing any interrogating of
no, that...
Or not interrogating. You wouldn't be interrogating. You'd be translating.
Well, translating. Well, I was... By that time, the army had set up a sort of Nazi hunting unit, and two Czech brothers, who I got very friendly with, and we were actually put together for denazification purposes. But they followed up all the leads, and that I just helped with some of the paperwork and some of the time, because their English wasn't so good, so that I managed to sort of help them out with translations and that. But they did the hunting. I just helped out. And then, of course, we had this terrible stream of displaced person come.
So what sort of things were these two doing, and what this anti-Nazi or anti-Nazification, what exactly were they doing?
Well, they were looking through local and having local contacts, and they had hold of local party lists and that, and hunting people Most of them obviously had gone to ground, but they got hold of some who tried to hide, and they were delivering them to the army for further interrogation and classification.
And you were more just really translating for them?
I was more or less just translating.
What about the displaced people?
Well, a lot of thousands of people had been let out of various concentration camps all over Europe, and there were a lot of them were just on the march trying to get to various countries, like to Britain, to America, and to safe places, and a lot of them had no idea where they're going to go, and all this had to be organized. And also, I had no direct input in that, except that, again, here and there, I was called upon in difficult cases where there were disputes or anything like that to do some translating. But then I was posted, again, at the time, we were by that time, we were actually stationed in a hotel on Lake Werther, which was near Klagenfurt, where we actually were stationed, near Klagenfurt on the lake. I don't know whether it's of any interest. The little village was called Percha, which is now a well-known seaside, lakeside resort in Austria, in Carinthia.
Now, who were you with at this time? I mean,
I was still with the RAF, but, you know, very much on my own devices. And then from there, this, again, was more or less just a rest for us after Klagenfurt, where I was actually stationed. This was a fortnight or so in a hotel for rest. And then I was attached during the winter to the RAF regiment, who did air mountain rescue services. I had to go through a skiing course and mountaineering course.
Now, what do you remember about that?
I remember I had to learn abseiling on the ropes up and down cliffs. I had to learn how to ski, which nearly cost me my life.
What happened?
What happened, we were on a cross-country march, guided by local guides. That was the purpose of my being there, to liaise between the local high-altitude people and the RAF regiment, who were in charge of the lower slopes, in case there were any air accidents, air crashes. And I was sort of last in line, and I suddenly lost my footing and went head first into the snow with my ski sticking up through the snow. And luckily enough, the local guide, who'd obviously been a ski instructor, or who was, I knew he was a ski instructor, in fact, he ever so often turned around and counted his sheep, and lo and behold, one was missing. So he came straight back and saw me with my feet, my ski sticking out of the snow. I was almost suffocating by then, and they dug me out. And ever since then, I must admit, although I've always been a brilliant ice skater, my love for skiing was dead and buried. I got the fright of my life, and that was my skiing days done. But no, and then we again. It was a case of just liaising, interpreting where necessary, but luckily enough, I don't think there'd ever been an air accident during the time I was there. So again, it was quite a nice interval for me.
Nothing happened?
Nothing happened, except we went on exercises, and as I spoke German, the local guides and I, we sort of got together some of the lads in a local hut doing the exercises and decided we weren't going to go very far, played cards, had a few drinks, and then went back to base. And the winter was good, except after 4 years nearly, at Christmas, my first home leave was due. And I shall never forget the journey from Villach to Calais in a train which had no windows in it, in the middle of winter, and it was icy. The heating was frozen, there was no heating. We were huddled in our greatcoats and compartments, and luckily enough, every hour or so, there was an American army unit by the side of the track, dishing out hot coffee and donuts, which kept us alive. And then we got into Calais, into a transit unit in Calais, waiting to go across to England the following day, which was round about the 21st of December, I should think. And there, lo and behold, was a real pea super of a fog, and we couldn't move. So we were really getting worried that we'd miss Christmas at home. But on the 23rd, the fog lifted, and we managed to get across to Dover. And I managed to have Christmas at home, but had to be back in Austria before the new year because we were taking it in turns. Some of the lads managed to get home for Christmas, others for the new year. So I had to be back by the, I think it was the 28th or 29th of December, to give the others a chance to get home. And then there were one or two little minor incidents. I took a half track up to a mountain hotel where some of our officers were based. And I was supposed to telephone from the bottom. Oh no, it wasn't a half track, it was a personnel carrier. So that a half track could come down and collect the people. Well, when I phoned up to the top of the mountain, I was told there was no half track available because the half tracks were going down the other side of the mountain to take the girls, the local girls who'd been up to the hotel for a dance the previous night, home the other side, or to the villages the other side. So I thought, I'm not hanging about down here. So I took my four by four truck up to the lake, myself, up the top. And the first person I ran into was the unit's MT officer, who told me that I was acting against strict instructions not to bring a non-track vehicle up. So I said, well, I came up here perfectly safe. I had a happy landing. So he said, see me in the office on Monday morning, which I did. And I had my driving license withdrawn for the next 3 months. Which I didn't need because I went home a month later anyway. So I was posted home, I think it was, yes, in May, I was posted home. I was posted home to POW.
Was there any party or anything?
No. I was posted to be a POW holding unit as my final farewell stop.
Where was that at?
Now, that is again, it was again somewhere in the Midlands. I can't remember exactly where.
And what were you doing there?
I was, again, the one and only German speaker. I was the interpreter for the unit. There was several hundred German POWs,